The Mincing Rascals podcast is sponsored by Ottawa, Illinois, the middle of everywhere. This fall, as the leaves are changing, get outdoors and enjoy some relaxation. Plan your trip today. Log on to visitottawail.com. Today is Wednesday. It's October 23rd, 2024, 2:37 in the afternoon, also known as T-minus 13 days. Hi, this is John Williams. This is the Mincing Rascals podcast. Share us with your friends and give us a good rating, too. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 10 to 2.
I'm Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute and co-founder of Iron Light, a marketing agency working to change the world. You can check out my book, The New Chicago Way, Lessons from Other Big Cities.
Hey, it's Brandon Poe, host of On the Block, powered by Block Club Chicago and WCIU, and contributor to numerous other platforms.
And I'm Kate Plies, former Chicago reporter and columnist, now doing the Chicago history website, Roseland Chicago 1972.
I'm Eric Zorn. I'm the publisher of the Picayune Sentinel, a weekly Substack newsletter. And you can write to me, Eric Zorn, at Gmail, and I'll add you to the list.
Okay, here we are about 2 weeks before the election, and of late, Donald Trump has staged working at a McDonald's to suggest that Kamala Harris is lying about having once worked there. Trump also rambled for several minutes this week about Arnold Palmer's penis, said his opponent is lazy as hell and she's a radical left lunatic, having already called her retarded. And he said to a schoolboy that his favorite presidents are Ronald Reagan and Abraham Lincoln, but then said Lincoln was probably a great president, although I've always said, why wasn't that settled? You know, I'm a guy that it doesn't make sense. We had a civil war. By the way, about that, Paul Krugman in the New York Times said, here's the thing. The civil war could not have been settled by moderating northern demands that the South give up its slaves, because there was no such demand. Northern states had banned slavery within their borders, and many northerners considered slavery abhorrent. But outspoken abolitionists who sought to end slavery everywhere were a small minority. If the South hadn't seceded, slavery might well have continued unimpeded for decades, he said. And one more note, in an Atlantic interview, former Chief of Staff John Kelly said Trump wanted the kinds of generals Hitler had. Brian Kilmeade on Fox about that then said maybe Trump didn't realize that the generals were Nazis. Maybe he didn't want the Nazi generals, just the good kind of generals in the 1930s and 40s who followed orders. All of this on the heels of the dance party he threw last week. In a normal year, that would have been compromising, but the needle hasn't moved much. Maybe right now, nothing matters. We're just all slogging away in this stew of nothingness, and nothing's going to matter. Is that where we are, Austin?
Are you asking me if I'm a nihilist?
That did sound like nihilism,
no.
Didn't it? For two
no,
weeks, 13 days of nihilism.
Yeah, I will say I think it's a very poor messaging strategy, and I'm saying this in broad strokes. Of course, this is not every Kamala Harris ad to every voter demographic, but in terms of the events that she's putting on and the press stories, it is still like doubling down on this kind of narrative of Trump is Hitler and we have to save democracy, doing events with Liz Cheney, having John Bolton in TV ads saying Trump's a threat to democracy. Purely from a messaging angle, we have seen from many polls that does not move working class voters as much as messages about the economy, about taking on billionaires and big corporations, about Trump trying to take away your health care. Those are things that can actually move voters. And I worry that it's sort of falling back into this same kind of rhetoric that people have heard now for like at least 4 years, which is that like it's Trump is Hitler and Trump is fascist. I don't think that moves the needle. And in the meantime, you know, obviously the entire McDonald's thing is a total stunt. It's like the purest form of stunt possible. It was everything is completely staged, of course. But if you just look at like sitting in a town hall with Liz Cheney versus going to a McDonald's and having like every meme on the internet for like 48 hours being Donald Trump at a McDonald's, Trump is winning that messaging battle, in my opinion, over that time period.
I disagree that he won the messaging battle. He was widely mocked for that. I don't know whose vote would have changed because they saw him wearing his tie and pretending to serve customers at a McDonald's. I would think that that stunt would be classified as a fail. On the other hand, because nothing seems to matter, I'm not sure it matters whether he was there, whether he could have just been having a coffee klatch with a few people. It doesn't. What Donald Trump does and says never does seem to move the needle. I do wonder, though, and think that this accumulation of statements of fear and horror from respected generals who worked with Trump. This is not your garden variety MSNBC Trump derangement syndrome, you know, as they call it. These are people who worked directly with him, John Bolton and General Milley and General Kelly. These people who are, you know, four-star generals who are extremely alarmed by Trump. I would think that that would start to penetrate some thick skulls about what a Trump election is going to be. The fact that he is ignorant and rash and fascistic and authoritarian, and that this is going to not be good for anybody, let alone working people who think they're going to somehow have their prices of their eggs lowered, or that somehow Trump is going to be better on immigration than he was for 4 years, or that he's going to have a better health care plan that he has failed to come up with for now almost 10 years. I wonder if some of these really high-profile people coming out could make a difference on the margins.
I hate to say it, but I just don't see that happening. We already had quite a few high-level people, ex-CIA directors, and other people who worked for Trump already giving people those warnings. So it just seems unlikely to me that these new generals aren't going to make a difference with the people that they need to make a difference with. I mean, maybe Kamala Harris is going to lose her convention bump no matter what. But here we are back again to an absolute dead heat, or even technically, like the Nate Silver model. It's so scary to say this, but the Nate Silver model has Trump with a 53.1% chance now of winning the Electoral College, where just a week or two ago, in that model, he was losing it. It's not going in the right direction for those of us who do feel that Donald Trump.
I wonder if she should be talking more about the economy. I think what Eric was referring to were the things that would make people like Eric feel good. And maybe economy talk would too, but it would just be so easy to, rather than criticize Trump, remind people that it's not as bad as you've heard, and gas is $3 a gallon.
I think they did finally kind of, the Democrats, including Kamala Harris, have finally kind of backed off of the whole message. You people who feel bad about the economy are just,
I know,
you know,
that's the wrong, well, because that's the wrong way to say that. Because that's the wrong way.
Yeah.
I know if your economy is stressed, if it's hard for you to afford groceries, then it's hard for you to afford groceries. There must be a way to convey to people. I have an idea for a commercial. Here it is. There's people in a valley and they're woe is me. And then here comes the cavalry, and the cavalry are all holding flags. The soldiers are. And one says unemployment 4.2%, and one says interest rates 2.4%, and one says Dow at 43,000. They've got all these economic flags. Here comes the cavalry, and they just come over the edge of the horizon, and now they're about to come on. They're about to save the people, and the people there in the valley go, nah, never mind. No, we don't want it. And it's like, no, you dummies. They're here to save you. Come on. They are right here, right now. They're going to save us. Don't send the cavalry back.
Well, I want to acknowledge that this may be the most difficult presidential campaign for a candidate in history, for Kamala Harris. With such a short window, the state of the Democratic Party, it's such a big tent where you have to walk so many tightropes on ideology, on policy. And now you also are trying to woo Republicans. You're trying to get you got the Cheneys on board. You should try to have them in the same, you know, big tent with Bernie Sanders and AOC. Like this it's a really navigation to have. And she's only had what? 100 days to do it, less than that. I don't know.
It's 3 months. 3 months, yeah.
It's tough. But I do think they could be doing more on the economic part. I think the struggle they're having that also adds to the difficulty of this all is the way that our media ecosystem is now. She has done a lot of stuff that we say she should do more of, talking about her economic plans, outreach to different communities specifically, putting out lengthy policy as if people care about policy, and it's just not breaking through. What does break through is Donald Trump and McDonald's. Donald Trump talking about Arnold Palmer's schlong and debates happening on CNN because of it. It just feels like a replay of 2016. Obviously not in a good way. I think for the Harris campaign, the best they can do so far, and this is, I just want to say this too. No one knows exactly what's going to happen. I see polls that say Harris is going to win. I see polls that say Trump is going to win. I see a lot of signs to say Harris could win, especially with disaffected Republicans and conservatives, the Nikki Haley voter. They may be the key to this election because will they show up? Our neighboring state, Indiana, in the Republican primary where Nikki Haley was already not a candidate, 28% of people voted for her. What happens to those people in those red states? And are these overtures to the right, to the Liz Cheney's, and to all these Republicans endorsing, is it going to make an impact? Based on conversations I've had with family that I have in conservative areas of Ohio and Georgia, who are scared to put out Kamala Harris signs because of the social sanctions that come with it, there may be a silent majority out there of people who are scared to say they're not voting for Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it just kind of the opposite of what 2016 was. But at the end of the day, there's probably polling out there that says the complete opposite. Who knows? And God bless us all.
For what it's worth, I'm in Michigan right now, and a good 4 hours up the mitten. So I'm not just like right next door. In 2016, the Trump signage here was huge. And quite a few neighbors had sign wars going with Trump people living across the street from Hillary people. And we took pictures of those and had a great time with all that. Last time around, it was a little bit less. And this time around, there is not a whole lot of signage. It's like both sides are just kind of like, enough already. So,
yeah.
You know, there's very little signage. It's really hard to say who's got more than the other. It's not at all clear who has more, but it just seems like that kind of fanaticism has peaked and gone, at least around here.
Yeah, or Kate, or it might be fear too, that that because tensions are so high that you don't want to put out a Trump sign or a Harris sign because you're afraid to put out a sign, as Brandon's relatives or friends are. I was in Michigan over the weekend, and in fact, my Zoom background is from the camp where I was. And signage that I saw was agreeably split because we were in rural parts of the state, and I saw quite a few Harris wall signs as well as Trump signs, admittedly. But again, it was not like it was 8 years ago or even 4 years ago. I'm still with Brandon. Who knows?
If a sign can be loud, the Trump signs are always louder. The signs are louder. They're bigger. They're just somehow more in your face. I think a Trump voter is more likely to put up a sign if they're worried about repercussions than a Harris voter. We just drove to Minneapolis, so that's straight through Wisconsin. And it was, as Eric said, agreeably split. We knew we'd see some Trump signs, but not as many as we've seen in the past. This is dangerously anecdotal.
I have a very dangerous anecdote if we're getting into that. I went to go early vote at the Lincoln Square early voting location yesterday evening. It's the Bud Long Library on Lincoln. And there was a young Arab-American dude, like fit guy in a MAGA hat. I've never seen a MAGA hat in Chicago my entire life. He was voting. And then there was also like the, you know, white dude who looks like me in the camo, the Harris Waltz camo hat. And I was like, this is America. It was crazy. It was crazy to see both of that in the same place. And there weren't that many. There was like five people there. It was very crazy that those were the two people. And then there's also school district candidate Bruce Leone for that district. Those are like three of the five people.
You understand that's a small sample size. Go ahead.
Very small sample size. Sample size literally three people. But if I was making the ad for Harris, to me, for these working class areas, is just Trump next to billionaire, next to billionaire, next to billionaire. He wants to cut taxes for billionaires and big corporations. He wants to cut your health care. He wants to cut Social Security. Like, that should be the only message, in my opinion. And this whole thing, I know it's not her whole campaign, but the Cheney thing to me is like, I feel like I'm going insane, because as recently as like Veep, that movie Vice came out in 2018, where everybody agreed that like Cheney is like Satan incarnate, John Bolton's a war criminal, that everybody's like, these guys are evil. And now it's like a part of, in the last 2 weeks, part of the campaign message. I just don't, that seems to be taking your eye off the ball in terms of what could actually animate working class voters who really need to be animated for the Harris campaign.
Like you said, Brandon, we absolutely have to acknowledge incredibly short campaign, incredibly tough road to hoe. I really wish that in addition to starting to do lots more interviews and all kinds of different places, I don't understand why Kamala Harris is widening her interviews, but then not widening the scope of her answers on the really, really sensitive ones that she gets asked. I'm like, I don't understand why go on Fox News if you have not decided we're getting close. I'm not clearly winning this yet. I'm going to finally have to say we made mistakes on immigration. I wish we had imposed some executive orders ourselves earlier, things like that. But instead, she, if you get away from how very rude Brett Baer was, well, he could have been ruder, but still, a lot of talking over her, even if it was in a nice voice. She didn't answer the questions. She still made a point of not answering those questions, including, are you still in favor of transgender surgery for undocumented immigrants who are in jail?
Talk about a small sample
size.
She
would not answer that.
I know that, and fine.
Saying, no, I've changed my mind.
Who cares?
I no longer think that's right.
She said,
oh, but look, Trump paid for that while he followed the law and paid for that. That's not answering the question. That's not getting people who are really concerned about that issue, who think it is a bellwether for your overall ideology. It's not making them feel better.
Yeah.
And these people still clearly need to be reached.
That Fox interview was fascinating. I think it was a win for her, honestly. I walked away from it thinking it showed what I think the campaign wanted to show. It showed her go into a hostile environment. It showed that she can be tough, that she can be thrown off and still... I thought the responses for the most part were pretty good.
But she didn't answer those questions, is my point. So like she totally did what you said. She showed herself to be able to be in an interview and be unflappable, unlike that horrible Lester Holt interview. So she's gotten past that. You're totally right. But she won it with people like us. I don't know that she moved the needle at all.
You think conceding that you think that suggesting that they botched immigration would be a plus for her?
I think you have to admit you made mistakes if you want people to believe that you truly intend to do things differently.
But you're writing their ad if you go on Fox and say, yeah, we screwed up immigration.
Well, where she wrote their ad for them was when she was on, I think it was The View, and they said, what's the difference between you and Joe Biden? What did you do? What would you do differently? And she just said, I can't think of anything.
Yeah, I get that.
Yes.
And that quote is just, I mean, it's horrifying and politically, because people are always agitating for change, right? That's every election is a change election. People are chronically unsatisfied. I mean, you look at the Wall Street Journal and the Economist came out with stories this week about, we have the most robust recovery from COVID of any country in the world, any major country in the world. We're doing better than they did. And the U.S. economy is doing well, and yet people feel like it's really doing poorly. So, you know, how do you, when you say people want change. They want some assurance. They want some plan. They want something to look forward to and say, well, yeah, we're just going to get four more years of Joe Biden. I think Joe Biden's been a pretty good president. I would gladly take four more years of Joe Biden, but even though he has clearly made some mistakes, gladly take four more years of him. But people want something else. They always do. And so that answer, it's unbelievable that she didn't have it. An answer to that question memorized. My goodness, you know what? Who is staffing that campaign that they're not ready for just the most obvious questions?
It's one of those things where she should have been prepped for it. I can't imagine it wouldn't have been in the prep. It's a very simple question that I feel like is an obvious question you would be asked, and she seemed thrown off by it. I always hate when I can answer a question better than the actual
game. Then you're not doing your homework.
So there's moments like that where it's like, yes, it doesn't look great, and I wonder how it's perceived. But then I look and I'm like, gosh, the double standard. Because the other guy, he's not really held to anything, is he?
Well, that's a media issue.
Well,
Austin,
that's his voters.
Austin, how would you have answered the immigration questions?
Well, I guess I'll start with the Joe Biden question. I think you go to some place like, well, listen, Joe Biden was a senator for decades. You know, I come from a very different place as Joe Biden. Here's how my background is different, and here's how I connect with people much differently, and here's how I see the world differently. I had a job as vice president. My job is to support the president and implement his initiatives. Now it's my turn to set forth a vision. I care about.
There you go.
Boy, how hard. I'm writing this. Hold on. Go slower. I'm writing this down.
For you.
Yeah.
Wow.
That, and instead it was, I'm not Joe Biden, ... And then that wasn't the first time she said that. I mean, she said that like three. She's been asked the question before, and she said that again. On immigration, you would probably want to say something like, I know that the American people are worried about safety at the border, and our administration shares that concern. Here's what's not the answer is demonizing people and calling in bomb threats to schools and all, you know, to play up the insane comments about the Haitian immigrants. That's what's not working. Here's what is working, putting together blah, blah, blah. Don't even talk about the past of the border, like talk about what you're going to do in the future. That's not a great answer, but yeah, I agree that the responses to both those questions should have been much better.
Can I just share with you this? I was at an event Monday night in Minneapolis. Radio station I used to work at there, WCCO, had its 100-year anniversary. They had a 100-year anniversary gala, and a lot of us who had worked there went back and did a sort of talk. We'd all come out and take turns talking to an audience. And one of the people that came out was Tim Pawlenty, who was the governor after Jesse Ventura and was a moderate Republican governor. And he still is a Republican, but he used to host a show on WCCO while he was governor. And he'd talk about the state. It wasn't firebrand stuff, but he isn't a firebrand. Anyway, the host on stage asked him about what politics is like now and how does he feel about it. And he did say this about the outcome of this election. He said he wasn't as worried about that. He said, look, we've got two vast oceans on either side of us. We have an economy that is the envy of the world. Our markets and our capital are the envy of the world. People want dollars still. Our education is better. Our every metric is better in the United States. And he said, we have an endless supply of water and energy and food. You know, we can survive anything. He said, I'm not saying the democracy isn't a delicate thing, but he said, I don't think it's so cataclysmic about the survival of America. And so everybody sort of breathed a little sigh of relief. I don't know that we're reminded of that enough. It felt good in the moment. I don't know if that is persuasive to people to stay the course when Donald Trump is saying we need to make America great again. Oh, wait, it's pretty damn good right now. But it was nice to hear that message.
Well, it sort of makes me feel better that someone like him said that. But here's where I'm coming from. I've been a gigantic fan of Dr. Strangelove. As you know, John, we've talked about it.
You and I love that movie.
Life. I grew up watching this movie on TV as a small child, The Mushroom Clouds, over and over and over again over the ending credits. Bottom line, if Trump wins, he is in charge of our nuclear strike force. I find that very, very frightening. And the fact that he is also the person who might drive someone else to use tactical nukes. Since you suggested your own political ad earlier, I wish the Harris campaign actually would do a new version of the Goldwater girl with the daisy ad, the mushroom cloud.
Mm-hmm.
That apparently really did its work to make people think that Barry Goldwater was too insane to be trusted with the Oval Office. And I might add that Dr. Strangelove could be in for a nice little revival, because my husband just mentioned to me that he read that the guy behind Veep, whose name I forget, is going to be doing a stage adaptation, a play version of Dr. Strangelove.
This doesn't concern me. I'm surprised that you're, of all the things, and I know just before we came into the studio, I saw that 3,000 North Korean troops are now in Russia. It just seems like that thing will not settle down, but I'm not borrowing that angst.
What about Iran? What about the fact that Iran could build a nuke within a week?
Well, I'm asking you guys about the election and what Tim Pawlenty said.
I'm sorry.
Well,
you're right. My point is, and we'll just move on from me, is simply that because one of my main concerns is having someone like Donald Trump in charge of nuclear policy and possibly attacking.
Right. So what T-Paw said doesn't pacify you in any stretch, just a tiny bit. Eric, what was your reaction to
it? Well, this idea that we're protected by these oceans, the nuclear portion of this equation makes it less comforting, because it's not impossible to smuggle nukes into the country through, cargo ships or whatever. So I think I share Kate's concern, and I'm not sure that I'm as pleased about T-Paw's, telling us all to calm down. So I'm pretty anxious about this, frankly. So I wish I could be soothed by words.
Well,
like
he didn't talk about nuclear weapons, you guys. Austin, what do you think?
I think that it's easy to tell people that they live in the most prosperous, amazing, miraculous time in the history of the world, which is totally true by any metric. And if you were to have to choose when to be born, not knowing anything about yourself, you would pick the present day and not any time in the past. However, and I thought this was a really interesting kind of side note. I think it was a Washington Post story about Elon Musk campaigning with Trump in Pennsylvania. And it was talking about Musk's appeal to young men in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the fact that he was a billionaire or that he had a lot of money. It was that he was a person who had a very clear purpose of making life, multiplanetary. And that struck a chord for me just in the fact that you could, have these material conditions be much better, but there is a real crisis of meaning and purpose, especially among young men across America. And if you don't have those things or community, you often turn to, some pretty dark places, including addiction. And that's why we see rising deaths of despair and decreasing participation in the workforce.
Yeah.
So I think those are some of the things that comments like that leave wanting.
Then it seems a little flat. I will say this, though, about that. Elon Musk is he's the personification of wasted opportunity. He does have the ears or the hearts of a lot of people, and he's wasting it on forwarding out disinformation. He could accomplish so much good, and he absolutely refuses to. I think about Elon Musk a little too much that way. I think what a great opportunity he's had, and he's just squandered it because he's such a juvenile. Also, some of my listeners think that Rudy Giuliani's punishment, speaking of juveniles, is greater than his crime. He has 5 days, I think it is, as of today, to surrender most of his assets to two election workers in Georgia. He owes them $148 million in compensatory and punitive damages for saying they were passing around USB ports like they were vials of heroin or cocaine. Said one of my listeners in an email or text message to the show today, do you really believe that if Rudy Giuliani were a Democrat, he would have had anywhere near the outrageous amount slapped on him? He's not that rich. This is truly just another demonstration of the system using its power to punish those who don't toe the line. And another said, don't you feel this judgment is excessive? Is it really proper to do to a person that is over 70? Do you really want to put him in bankruptcy? bankruptcy? Can't the courts use common sense rather than ruin a person based on his political belief? Eric, what was your reaction to the $148 million and the liquidation of his assets?
Glee was my reaction. I mean, what Rudy Giuliani did and said was contemptible to those people, and he is an awful person, and I don't feel any sympathy for him. It does strike me that $148 million is excessive. It does. I don't mind that he's been driven into bankruptcy. You know, you got to think about that before you start just slandering and libeling people who are just doing their job. That was what he did was awful. And I would rather see a guy like that spend some time in jail than have to just be totally bankrupted for the rest of his life. But I don't want to minimize what he did. And I think that your reader is way off base. It wasn't that Rudy Giuliani didn't toe the line. That's an idiotic thing to say about what he did and said and the role that he played in this extremely terrible effort to overturn an election. I mean, that was very serious what he did. So if he suffers, then fine. That's fine with me.
But I want to interject this, Eric, because what you just said at the end of that commentary was that what he did wasn't just defame two ladies. What he did in service to overthrowing the election was defame those two ladies. The $148 million crime here isn't just what happened to those ladies, although actually that appears to be the confines in which that judgment was determined. But really, the bigger crime is he was trying to overthrow an election. He was using these ladies as props to that. So how does that not explode the judgment? And by the way, he didn't have $148 million. The assets are valued at about $6.8 million. So these ladies might get a few million dollars each, which is real money where I come from. But I think that number, if Rudy had $149 million, Brandon, would you say take 148 of them? Or if, say, he had $148 million in a nickel, would you take every dime from him, Brandon?
Yeah. I would, but I'm with Eric on this. I really feel like the crimes that he committed are egregious. He put two black women's harm at stake, put them at risk all over an election lie. When you mount that on top of all the stuff he's done leading up to that, and then you look at his whole career as mayor, where he demonized the homeless and weaponized the New York Police Department against black and brown people through stop and frisk and so many other policies. I'm shedding no tears for Rudy Giuliani. You play stupid games, you get stupid prizes, and that's a stupid prize. You put two innocent women's lives at risk over a lie because your guy didn't win, and that's the consequence.
Wonder what you could get for an autographed Joe DiMaggio t-shirt now, or 26 watches.
A lot.
One of which was given to him by, I'm thinking of that scene from Pulp Fiction. If I had a watch and it was from my grandfather, you know, I would really value that. And the judge said, your sentimental value means nothing to the court. It's an asset.
There's two concurrent thoughts in my mind. I feel gross when I think about Rudy Giuliani. I don't know if there's a public figure who's ever gone from such highs to such lows in American life over such a short period of time, going from America's mayor to just like a complete joke. And what he said was extremely harmful and disgusting. On the other hand, if I take away all the personalities of this case, I always get a knot in my stomach about people having, you know, these massive settlements for what amounts to, you know, really irresponsible
speech,
disgusting, ugly speech. And you really don't want to live in a place where there's a threat of if you're saying something that is crossing a line in some way, either way, right, that is insulting to people. It could be disgusting, it could be personal, but it doesn't mean that you're going to be dragged in front of a court and taken for all you're worth. That has a chilling effect on speech. regardless of, you know, what the content is of this particular case. So I'm holding those two things in my head.
I hope it would have a chilling effect on cavalier speech or lying, which is worse than cavalier speech. But it was such cavalier lying, knowing it's not true. And I don't care. Hey, we're trying. The end justify the means. We're just going to say crap about these ladies. Who cares? They're just a couple of black ladies and nobody ever heard of them.
It did make their lives hell, as I recall. And so he didn't take that into account either. I mean, I hear what Austin is saying, that you don't want anyone to say, like, to say, well, I have doubts about the election results. And they say, well, you're going to jail because you're impugning the system. Plenty of people, plenty of Republicans and conservatives have expressed
this wasn't
about
that,
the
though,
authenticity. But it was not that. That's what I'm saying. I don't think anyone should be afraid to say whatever they want about the general thrust of the election. But pointing the finger at these two women and accusing them of committing a federal crime, that's libelous or slanderous, I guess.
Slanderous.
But I take that seriously, and I don't think that it impinges on freedom of speech that you can't make a grotesquely false allegation against someone just willy-nilly, whether you're in the service of yourself or of Donald Trump or anything. I mean, you do have to be careful about slandering people, and I don't think that chills free speech so much.
Austin, what's the penalty going to be then if you think that this is chilling or egregious, or as one of my listeners put it, gregarious.
The penalty comes in the court of public opinion of people saying, you know, this guy is a total joke, as I said.
But you got to fine him or jail him, don't you? I mean, so what's the penalty?
I would need to know a little bit more about the details of this case, but it is very hard to make a case to me that even if you're talking about specific people and accusing them of doing something, even if it's not true, if it turns out not to be true, sometimes cavalier speech is true, or sometimes it's in a gray area. And it's really tough for me to endorse a system where it's like, okay, we're going to go to court to decide whether this claim that you made that was really a spicy, bad take should be, you know, you should be liable for millions of dollars for saying that. It's not going to be so clear cut all the time.
I was waiting for Brandon to chime back in there. I thought he was loading up.
By the way, we see this in European countries. This happens a lot. You know, people, like, there are laws like these in the UK, especially, where it's like, people making disgusting jokes on the internet, and then the police come up and, you know, show up at their house, and they're arrested and they go to jail. And that is that's a real threat to the First Amendment when you start doing that.
Well, it's just a way for justice to speak, isn't it? I mean, it's a number, and it could have been a zillion dollars. He doesn't have a zillion dollars either, but it just struck me as wow. And then, you know, they're hauling away his television. They're taking his sofa. They're taking his grandfather. This is almost beside the point, but I'm happy to see that. I don't know if that's justice.
It's hard to feel sorry for Rudy Giuliani, let me be clear. And I don't really feel too sorry for him. But this is the problem when you're talking about free speech stuff, is you end up having to defend people that you otherwise would not want to defend.
Well, good that you do. All right, let's not talk about that the entire podcast. I've got something else I want to get to, a couple of things. But I also want to get to this. Our sponsor, Ottawa, Illinois, is the middle of everywhere. Surrounded by open spaces and rivers and trails, Ottawa is a natural setting that allows you to get outdoors and enjoy some fall relaxation. Settle down and snuggle up in one of Ottawa's nearly 400 rooms. Everything from established hotels and resorts, private rentals and B&Bs. Plan your fall trip today at visitottawail.com. Brought to you by Ottawa, the middle of everywhere, and the Illinois Office of Tourism. Okay, now back to the Mincing Rascals. How about this, guys? Should the limit in Chicago, speed limit, go from 30 miles an hour to 25? A pedestrian and traffic safety committee on the city council passed that idea onto the full council, 8-5, and they may vote on that as a full council next year. They say it makes car-person collisions more survivable. I wonder if the city would be proposing this, Kate, if the measure wasn't going to generate more money for the city. Is this about safety, money, or both? What do you think?
A bit of both, but it definitely includes money, no matter how much they want to claim not money. I would have to see a whole lot of evidence that lowering, yes, we know that lowering the speed limit will always create more survivability, but how much more survivability from 30 to 25 compared to what we know is really the big culprit for accidents right now, which is distracted driving and infrastructure too, in terms of pedestrian safety. And it's going to be incredibly problematic, which is evidenced by Mayor Johnson backing it, but then not helping it pass committee and saying that the important thing is that it be applied equitably. And just in case people don't know, the sponsoring alderman has already himself put off having this even be voted on in the full council in order for them to somehow figure out how they would pass this law without apparently it being a regressive tax on poor drivers, which I think the only way you could possibly do that is maybe if you only enforce it in the Gold Coast.
That's the thing.
When you're talking about Brandon, because Brandon lives there.
When you're talking about poor, you mean low income drivers, because we want to get poor drivers off the road. We want to put bad drivers off the road.
Right. I mean, low income. And obviously, what the aldermen are concerned about is that it's going to be largely Black and Hispanic drivers, low income Black and Hispanic drivers getting pulled over or getting tickets from the cameras.
Paul Vallis expressed his reservations in a Tribune op-ed that was published on Wednesday, and I think a lot of it had to do with whether it was going to be fining the low-income drivers, minority drivers, and so on. The speed limits are an interesting idea in general, that at 30 miles an hour, you're going to get a certain number of fatalities, and if you lowered it to 25, you'll get fewer fatalities. There's no question about that. You lower it to 20, and you get even fewer fatalities. Lower it to 15, and you'd get almost no fatalities, because 15 miles an hour just isn't that fast. Or lower to 10. And so the question is, so there is a balance. You have to figure out what is the balance between efficiency of traffic movement. You don't want people to have to take like 2 hours to get to their work. And I don't know how much time a diminution of the speed limit will add to people's commutes and the kind of time they can spend at home, the kind of time they can spend at work. I mean, there are all sorts of little variables here. Just the fact that it saves lives is should be part of the question. Sure, you don't want it to be 60 miles an hour on Irving Park Road, for instance, but you also don't want it to be 10. So where you put that line in the middle, and what are the things you have to consider? Those are things that I haven't really thought much about, but I certainly see what the questions are supposed to be.
I think about it all the time because I drive downtown all the time.
I think it puts Johnson in a very tricky position because he campaigned on getting rid of regressive fines and fees, and there's no way. I mean, he's talking about implementing this in an equitable way. I don't know how you actually do that in practice. I mean, there are thousands of people who have gone into bankruptcy because of these kinds of tickets in Chicago. And we're literally talking about for speed camera tickets. And I'm incredibly biased on this because I've gotten hit by the same speed camera ticket on Western like an embarrassing number of times. So like I'm particularly
is it double digits?
This,
is it two digits?
For going 6 miles an hour over the speed limit. Yeah. But if you're going 31, you're getting a $60 ticket. Like just like that.
That's
and
the new math.
This is the kind of stuff where, to Eric's point, there's trade-offs. And these kinds of like nitty-gritty kind of, it's called policing for profit often. Not nitty-gritty, like ticky-tack tickets really decreases the quality of life and makes people hate the city. I think that's never really discussed in terms of these tickets, but I think it really degrades trust and the relationship that you have with the place that you live when you feel like you're just being constantly unfairly milked for money, even though like your property tax bill might be whatever, 12 grand, but like it's the $60 ticket.
That's the truth.
And the problem isn't really people who are driving 30 miles an hour who you might get to lower to 25. The problem is the volume of people who started driving like complete maniacs during COVID. I know that right by me, I live right off of Lakeshore Drive around 54th Street. We get people blown off Lakeshore Drive at 53rd and also at the previous exit of 51st. And they just come tearing through the neighborhood like they never did before. And I can confidently say that because a couple of weeks ago, for the first time ever, and I've been on my corner for 40 years, a car came whipping off Lakeshore Drive, turns down 54th Street, and literally flips over after hitting a couple of cars, missing mine parked just this by literally a hair. Driving has just been out of control.
I don't have much dog in the fight since I am not a Chicago driver. So far be it from me to have any fiery opinions on what you drivers do.
You're a pedestrian.
I am a pedestrian. And so as a pedestrian, I'm like, hey, this is going to help me not get hit by a car. Beautiful. I have actually been, I don't want to make it sound dramatic, but I have been hit by a car before as a pedestrian. And it wasn't fun. It was kind of funny, but it wasn't fun. I'm still standing. And they were going probably 20, 25 miles per hour. So, you know, wow. I don't have any scientific data, but yeah, there might be something to it. Ultimately, the way I look at it is I am a big advocate for public transportation. I think this is a city that needs to be better on public transportation because so many people in the city depend on it. And this is a city that tends to punish people for driving with all the fines and fees and city stickers and parking enforcement. It just seems like if you're a driver in the city, they just make it very difficult. So if this gets more people on CTA, that'd be great. Maybe boost the CTA itself. Then it could be a win overall for the city. Other cities have done this. New York City does it. They went from 30 to 25. Boston and Portland. If Chicago does it, it'll happen. People will be mad for a week. They'll get over it, and all will be good. But I hope it has a residual effect where people maybe say, hey, instead of driving, maybe I hop on the red line instead or take the bus, help lower emissions, help lower all this crazy gridlock traffic we have, get more people off the roads.
Brandon, in that article that Paul Vallis put in the Tribune today, or the Tribune put in Paul Vallis today, he writes, ProPublica reports that 8 of 10 zip codes with the most accumulated ticket debt per adult are majority black, accounting for 40% of all the debt. And I know what my listeners will say sometimes. And by the way, he also notes that according to another study in Mother Jones, 7% of the city's operating budget in 2016 came from these kinds of tickets, which is a lot. That's why I said when we began this to Kate, would they be doing this if it didn't generate money, or would they be doing this if it cost them money? And I don't think it would. I'll tell you what my listeners would say, then don't drive too fast. If you can't pay the fine, don't do the crime. And I have no idea how you make this equitable or fair. What was the word that Brandon Johnson used? How do you make this racially sensitive? I don't know how you do that. I don't even know if you should do that.
I think you stick with camera enforcement and not have it be human enforcement. I think that's where things get murky. So if you're having camera enforcement, detector enforcement that's consistent, as it is in Gold Coast, the same it is in Bronzeville, same it is in back of the yards, then hey, it is what it is from that point.
Austin, you've been away for a couple of weeks, and we've been saying bad things about you, by the way. Actually, more than once, there's been an issue that's come up, and we thought, well, if Austin were here, he would have something to say about this. And at least once it was about the school board. Marge has persuaded me that the school board's too big. I don't think electing school board members is a good idea because people don't know who they are, and we're vulnerable to small interests with a lot of money.
It's been just complete chaos over the last 2 months. It's hard to even know where to start. You had just 2 days ago, Jen Johnson, who is the former chief of staff for Chicago Teachers Union. She became the deputy mayor for education under Brandon Johnson, like most trusted of the trusted CTU person at the heart of Brandon Johnson's administration. She stepped aside for an indefinite amount of time. She cited health issues. Brandon Johnson has put forth for 2 weeks, it was just 6 of the 7 interim board members. He is now named the 7th. The 7th is Rafael Yanez. He is a
police officer,
multiple times failed city council candidate. His number one donor in running for city council was the Chicago Teachers Union. And I very much expect at the school board meeting, which is not this Friday, but the next Friday, for them to move to fire Pedro Martinez. I think that entire saga has been an utter waste of everyone's time. Firing Pedro Martinez is going to do nothing for the city, for the children of the city of Chicago. It's a complete power play to try to get through this loan that's extremely irresponsible. That loan will not be approved. I know that for sure. In 2 weeks, they have to go through an entire process of a budget amendment where they have hearings, et cetera, before doing that. But I do think they could move to fire Martinez. That will probably kick off a legal fight between Martinez and the district, just creating more and more and more chaos as the district's financial position gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And I think Eric has said this before. It's just really kind of the worst nightmare and the prediction of people who said that you cannot have someone who's this closely tied to the other side of the bargaining table be in charge of the city. And we're seeing all the cross compromise that happens with that and his inability to be independent come to fruition. And it's a bad look for the city. We're getting national press on this now. Washington Post had a great piece this week about the chaos within the school district. And it's happening at a really bad time for Brandon Johnson as he tries to get a city budget passed before the end of the year. Early voting's open if people want to go vote for people for the school board, because that's something we can do instead of just complaining about it, is elect people who are not beholden to that entire political machine.
So what am I supposed to do if I see school? I'll be able to vote for a school board member when I go into the – I haven't voted yet, Austin.
Unless you live in District 5, which is an uncontested race, you will have a choice in the school board election. So
I know,
we have a lookup tool. If you search Illinois Policy school board lookup, you can see which district you're in and who's been endorsed by the CTU and who Illinois Policy's PAC.
One of the things we talked about last week was some of the mailers from the people who are opposing the CTU, the union-backed mailers, are branding those who are not with the union as people who are marionettes of Trump, who are supporting Trump's 2025 agenda, which I thought was such a low blow. And I know politics is dirty, but these mailers were so infamous that I'm inspired to vote for the candidate that's not backed by the CTU, given that the CTU is going to control the board after this election anyway. I think there needs to be some balance on this board. I don't want the school board to be dominated by CTU members, even though I'm much more in favor of the CTU and I'm much more of a union guy, a labor guy than Austin is, or the Illinois Policy Institute is. I can't vote for somebody whose campaign is leveling such infamous charges. So I'm probably going to vote for the same person that that Austin would vote for if he lived in my district, which is a nice moment of harmony, I guess. I don't know.
A rare moment of harmony. So the voter guide would be get the CTU recommended people and then just vote for anybody that isn't them. Then don't vote for any of those people.
Well, I would make it a small addendum to that, which is we actually asked every single candidate if they would take a pledge to never take money from Brandon Johnson or the CTU. And that's how Illinois Policy PAC made its endorsements, was the people who signed that pledge. There are some districts where there was actually only one or two districts where multiple people signed it, and then you had to make other considerations to make the endorsement.
Yeah.
But I think that that's really important. And this is the playbook from the Chicago Teachers Union. Everybody who criticizes them is MAGA. Every policy that isn't theirs is Project 2025. We just saw this 2 weeks ago. Five members of the Chicago Teachers Union filed a lawsuit asking for audits, which the union has refused to provide to them for 4 years. And Stacey Davis Gates put the names and photos and names and photos of all those union members up in a meeting saying, these people are MAGA, these people are right wing, these people are Project 2025. These are dues paying members of her own union. I think unless there are more people like Eric who are just like, I refuse to, listen to these crazy accusations that everything that is critical of the status quo is right wing, they're going to keep using that tactic.
I think it is important, though, to state, just like not everybody that's non-CTU is bad, the same goes for people that are CTU. Just because they are part of CTU doesn't mean that they are in favor of Brandon Johnson's, what he's doing. It doesn't mean they're in favor of what their union may be doing. They're teachers. They're part of the union. So I think it's important to also not just go off of whether they're backed by CTU or whatever, but also just look at what are their priorities for your district, your schools.
I kind of stay with what I said last week. In fact, I already filled out my my mail-in ballot, I did vote for the person not backed by CTU. And my thinking in that, Brandon Johnson is going to have 10 of those positions plus the president. So he's already going to dominate the school board no matter what.
He'll have 11 to 21, yeah.
And I believe in checks and balances. There's got to be some voices on this board that aren't just automatically backing the CTU's positions. So it was pretty easy for me this time around. It's going to get more difficult as time goes on.
I would like to see a balance of philosophies and power on that school board, because I think a lot of different kinds of voices need to be heard. I'm probably, Kate, much more in line with you in terms of my feelings about school. In fact, I may even be less enamored with school choice than you are, but I do feel like it's important not to have a rubber stamp school board, because that's why we wanted to get away from a mayoral. If you want a mayor, the mayor to appoint the school board, if you want someone who's just in line with the mayor, then we shouldn't have gone to an elected school board, which I don't think we should have, but that's a discussion for another day. But if we're going to have an elected school board, I'd like to see it be a deliberative body and not a rubber stamp.
So it's a tough one. And the school really didn't have that discussion, which is, I think, unfortunate.
That's Kate Plies. Good to hear Kate. And Eric, Austin, good to have you back. Brandon.
Great to be back, guys. Good to be with you.
T-minus 13 days, y'all. That's it. We are produced by Brandon Pope and Pete Zimmerman. We are produced
You're
by
produced
Brandon.
By Brandon Pope? Wow, that guy is everywhere. He is truly everywhere.
Ben Anderson, which sounds like Brandon Pope to me, and Pete Zimmerman. And I get to vote. That's the scary thing. Okay, we're produced by somebody, and I'm someone, and we'll drop another podcast on you next week. All right.
All right.
Bye, campers. See you
later.
Bye.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.